Welcome to Soundwalker. This is your host, David Rothenberg. This is episode 14. Today we're speaking with Jon Balka, the great Norwegian improviser, pianist, composer, synthesizer of musics from all over the world, from Norwegian nature to West Africa to the Middle East to the world of jazz. I had been particularly intrigued by Balka's solo recordings where he overlaid his piano playing with electronic soundscapes. Some were field recordings, some were synthetic sounds remixed, and always in the background, interacting live in a very unusual way with his improvising left and right piano hands. So I decided in this podcast to overlay various bits of Balka's vast musical creative oeuvre together with us talking, discussing where this came from, where it's going, and wondering what the right level is, the mix between word and music, between art and idea. So welcome. Hope you enjoy it. You know, you earlier were playing in more traditional jazz contexts, but I think always were interested in mixing jazz and other kinds of music, correct?
The first really professional situation was with the R.L. Anderson Quartet. I was just 19 when I was invited to come to his house, and we started rehearsing, and then before I knew it, we were touring in Europe, recording for ACM.
So what did that feel like? What did it feel like to be 19 in such a context?
Well, that was just an immense flow in a way that everything was just happening very fast and completely fascinated by traveling in Europe and playing concerts and entering these clubs and all that. That type of life was very satisfying at that time.
Yeah, and you were doing that for many years.
Yeah, we did. I left Ariel's group in 77, I think, and then in parallel we worked also with Ratka Tonev and her quintet, where Ariel was also there.
Glasses full of rye. All the news is bad.
Did you play on All the Sad Young Men? I used to listen to that over and over again.
We played that a lot.
Are you on the recording?
The one. Yeah, I think
you, right?
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Right now, I don't remember.
We'll send it to you, we'll figure out.
Or Lars Danielsson, but I think I'm on it.
As a sad young man, I listened to that over and over again, living in Norway, age 23 or so.
Like,
this is it, you know. This is what it's like.
Around 83, we started with Mascolero, with Jon Christensen and Harald Andersen, Lisbeth Molde and Tore Brunbo, which then became like the main project, because it was, we toured a lot, we played, there was really a great attention to that group, and we had the possibility to travel. We were in New York, we were across the USA, we were around in Europe, so it became like a main project for some years. I also moved to Paris in that period, so and stayed there for 1 year. You know, it was jazz in Paris was a kind of a disappointment to me, I would say. was a very mainstream oriented, very USA oriented, with some nice exceptions. But the art scene in Paris was really happening at that time. And there was so much performance stuff to go and see and listen to. And for me, it was, I had just a year of studying it arbitrarily, different art, cinema, composition. I was working with the orchestration lessons and so on. So it was just, for me, a year of digesting lots of impressions.
And then so you came back, and how did it feel coming back to Norway?
You know, it felt good because I got very, in the end, I got very annoyed by this big city machinery working, all the sound, the bad water, the lousy apartments I was living in, so coming back to Norway with this clean nature, sparkling kind of energy just from the environment.
How would you describe Norway's particular affinity for jazz, given its nature orientation and its opposite to big city life, and yet it's a country with a really rich jazz tradition? Is that just some kind of accident, or is it is there some deep connection there?
It's an enigma. I don't know if I can explain it. I've tried many times, but I think there are some key words, which I think one of them is listening, ability to listen, which has something to do with nature, that you can exist in nature. And but the best way to be in nature is to actually to listen to it and pay attention to what is going on. And we all grow up with that in a way. Some kind of these Sunday excursions into nature and all the holidays in the mountains or by the sea. So. But that's not explanation enough, I think. For my generation, there was a freedom that I felt I wanted to be near, and at the same time, everything happened with the ECM and with the Jan Garbarek and all that sort of volcanic eruptions of new music and interesting ideas combined with political activity and thinking. And it was a very happening time there in the beginning of the 70s, when I really started to focus.
Could you say something on how the music was connected to the political ideas of the time?
I think this was kind of a post-hippie era where the whole ideology of total freedom and flower power and all that sort of had played its role, and there was a time to discuss seriously, I think, what was needed to move things in a better direction. It was post Vietnam, it was post a lot of stuff. Norway was having these elections about going into the European Union, so it was a lot of activity and communication, discussions in the youth or in the young adult generation that I was in. And of course, these discussions and this activity was very much in the same places as the jazz was happening, like in Club 7, and there was this student clubs up at Sogn in Oslo. And it was more or less the same bunch of people, you know, that that were active in both.
Was there anything musically in the music that people would say, this is the music of this movement, this is the music of change?
Yeah, but it's not so difficult to imagine that, actually. And also because the jazz was a kind of a message about freedom, and you had all the Art Ensemble of Chicago, you know, Cecil Taylor, all of that was happening, you know, kind of black consciousness thing going on. It was that very many lines you could connect to all of that. And we also played in Eastern Europe, which was then behind the Iron Curtain, and free jazz then was really important to the Polish resistance movement. I mean, they went totally crazy. I mean, and we played with the Earl Anderson Quartet, their sort of powerful with Juhani Aaltonen was playing with us, and he's very energetic, kind of Coltrane, Interstellar Space kind of tenor playing. They were, people stood up, you know, 5,000 people in the culture palace there in Poland screamed, like a pop concert with free music. So it's the that kind of message of freedom, I think, has had an appeal and still has.
Did you ever run across Sigmund Kvalloy's jazz culture analogies back in the 70s when he would do these performances and say, like, the orchestra is the old way and jazz is the music of revolution and collectivism, and he did these cool drawings and things.
I actually was together with him in this, there was a sit-down demonstration at a waterfall in the northwest of southern Norway, called Mardøla. It was a kind of we went up in the mountains there, everybody was chained just to stop them from putting this beautiful waterfall in the pipes. And he was there at that time, at the same time that I was there. People were coming and going. So I remember speaking to him, but I was, you know, I didn't have this academic urge to analyze what I was doing. I was just into a kind of intuitive learn as much as possible and play as much as possible.
That was my motto. For å hindre at arbeidet ble tatt opp igjen.
I imagine he would have appreciated that. Definitely. You know, I spent a lot of time with all these guys, you know, in the 80s in Norway, and over the years since. So I know how much they love jazz, you know, and talked in different ways. And we still have Niels Forlund is still around. He's a total jazz fan. And if you haven't talked to him, I recommend talking to him. He loves the Jazz Cafe in Oslo. He'll come in. He's probably close to you. He's somewhere near Gjøvik now, you know, and he just loves jazz so much. He's totally fine. He's in his 80s and he's a mountain man who cares about culture and music in this period.
Okay.
Because he's maybe almost the last one standing, and he looks the same. He like looks younger than he did.
I started this Magnetic North Orchestra, which was a continuation of that idea then to bring the energy level down to more like a chamber music situation and reduce the cymbals and you know heavy drumming and pull it more towards percussion. It was really very inspired by Kalthum, if you know the Egyptian, that kind of chamber music setting that with the string arrangements and stuff that that Abdel Wahab made for her was a really big inspiration. But I felt that I couldn't try to make some kind of fake Arabic music, so I just took the idea of the orchestration and then pulled it into my musical practice. You know.
Did you spend time in that part of the world if you got interested in kind of Arabic music?
I was I didn't go to Egypt at that time, but I was in Morocco several times. And kind of combination with vacation and with girlfriend and trying to get into as much music listening as possible. But not really spending time there, no. I didn't do that. It was mostly through listening to records and to... This was also the time where world music slowly became available to Europe, in a way. Because the first time I heard Kalthum was by lending some LPs from a girl who was an archaeologist who had studied in Egypt. She brought these records home, and I think that was the only records in Norway with that music. And also Radka Tonev had, because her father is Bulgarian, she had these recordings with what later became the Mustar Brigade, you know? Which also was a kind of a mind-blowing thing to listen to. And nobody had these records. No, it was not available until 10 years later. You know? The first time I heard this music, was in the 80s, but or 70s actually. But Magnetic North happened in 92, and that became my main project then for almost 10 years. First as a 13-piece group, then reduced to 8, then to 6. As a overlapping that, we had we started this Batagraph percussion, which was just the intention was just to meet and check out different stuff. Why does it sound like it does in West African Wolof music? Why does it? What can we do with these rhythms to make them more interesting and so on? We didn't actually plan to play concerts at all. But someone invited us to play a concert in Oslo, and then we were invited here and there, and suddenly it was like a performing band. But we still kept this kind of spending time just playing and recording and discussing and researching into all kinds of aspects of rhythm, actually. And also there this idea or this interest in the relation between language and rhythm became stronger and stronger just to set up situations where we could confront the language with our playing.
Were you speaking of which languages here, like African languages or words or musical language?
No, I mean language, like spoken language. But also we did concerts with Jaap Blonk, like sound poets. And Sidsel Andresen, when this was the time when she was also leaving melodic music and going into this kind of sound poetry improvisations. And it sounds nice to call it research, but it was more like kind of what happens if we do this, and then we did it, and we discussed after how we experienced that, and then another idea came up. What happens if we do this? So it's just like a flow of experimental settings.
Was it something about the approach to African rhythms and African music that made you think about language in ways that didn't come up in the jazz context?
Yeah, the thing is that what I grew up with was playing strict time, you know, in the tradition of Tony Williams and Miles in the 60s and 70s. So that was my, you know, my motivation for a long time was to play this kind of sharp 16 notes phrased streams of crystal clear time. Anyway, and then being in Gambia sort of just gave me a totally different perspective on what rhythm could be, with this polyphonic Wolof music and these sudden unison phrases that were elastic and flexible and not constricted to a kind of a beat at all. And then, of course, that's a short link there to how do we speak? We don't speak in time. We don't phrase what we say in time. So there must be some kind of, there must be something there between language and this kind of elastic rhythms. We didn't talk about C1, but that's...
Tell me how that began, because I was very impressed by that record when I heard it. And when did you first meet John Hassell?
I met him we played a concert on the same stage in Italy that must have been 2005 or something. It was this photographer who made a lot of covers for ECM, Roberto Massotti, who had a kind of he made a photo exhibition of all his photos, and then he put together this, for him, a kind of a dream band. So it was with Terje Rypdal and me and Miki Andoy and two Italian DJs and Anja Lechner and John Hassell. I think that was it. And then while we were rehearsing for a couple of days, and one of those days we had the day off, and I was eating breakfast with John Hassell, and we started to talk, and then we ended up sitting there for 3 hours just talking about everything, you know. And it was so I was so surprised that it was so easy to communicate with him. Him being the hero that I had always listened to, but also felt very open and also very listening to whatever I had to tell him and asking questions about Norway. So, but then I came home, and then in 2007 I got this commission again to write a piece for Cosmopolite, which is the club. And the owner there being Milo Gider, who is a Moroccan who came to Norway and has dedicated his life to build up this kind of world music scene, stage. I wanted to make something connected to him and his background. And then I've sat down with him, with Milod, and listened to a lot of Moroccan music. And then at that time I had made already quite a big number of projects with world musicians. But I felt we never really got to be a real fusion, because they kept doing what they did, and I tried to make some music that could fit to that, but you know, there was not really a meeting. But then I heard Amina Alaoui, who is this singer from Morocco, who's singing in the tradition of Andalusian music. That's her upbringing. And she sounded to me just like Sitzel Andresen, or many of them, the modern vocalists that I had been working with. So we decided to ask her.
What was she most skeptical about?
She had already done some kind of fusion projects with some European composers and orchestra stuff, and she felt that she had no place. She felt forced into a kind of a very narrow musical space. So, but then I went down to Granada, where she lives in Spain, with Bjarte Eike, a violin player, and I had then made some sketches, and we played them for her, and we discussed back and forth. And she is also a musicologist, so she came up with all this beautiful poetry from Al-Andalus, from 1100, 1200, around that time. And then we had, okay, this can become something real. And then I went home, composed more of the music, sent to her. She adapted it to from Spanish to Arabic. And in that process, I got this idea that this must be something for John Hassell to enjoy. So I sent him an email and said, it's nice talking to you last time. Do you want to join this project? And he just said, yes, sure. When and how and what? And I sent him some of the music, the sketches, and he responded and said, yes, anytime, I'm coming. So we got this project together then, and I told Manfred about it, and he said, yeah, we have to record this. And then we met, rehearsed, and did this concert at Cosmopolite, and then we went into the studio for a first session. And we had organized some more concerts in Norway next spring. This was in November, I think, 2007. So spring 2008. We met again and finished the recording. And we went to play this festival concert in Norway. And then suddenly we had a group, and the music, the record was released, and it won a lot of prizes, and it was invited to many festivals that could afford a big projects like that. So that was the start of it.
And now you've made a second record.
In a way, the running of Siwan was a kind of a really heavy business to to achieve. Because John Hassel had to be flown over, and of course I had to pay him properly, and Amina had kind of a difficult management at the time, and there were, you know, some struggles around every concert that in the end I felt, I don't know if this is worth it. And then we did some versions with the different other vocalists, like Camilla Gibran and Lamia Badoui, a Tunisian beautiful singer. But it still didn't really work out in the way that I felt. I needed a band, in a way. I needed a kind of a collective that, you know, we could play with the music and experiment and spreadsheets. The first version of Sivan was really me as a composer and the stars on top of it, you know, like, very higher hierarchy. I never learned that word in English.
Right, yes, the hierarchy.
Hierarchy. And then I found Mona Butcherbuck through Khairedin, the Algerian violin player. He suggested that let's try her, you know. And she came in just as a musician in the group, in a way. Like, very easy to work with, very sharp. She learned everything just in a couple of weeks and performed beautifully, and it was really kind of a happy moment where I felt that, okay, now we have the band, so let's record this. So I finished a new series of songs to Andalusian poetry, and we recorded that, and we've been touring with that since. And we've been in playing around in Europe, and also in Konya in Turkey.
Now John Hassel isn't in this round.
No, because it became too expensive actually to keep that going. But also his health was going a bit up and down.
Have you talked to him recently? How's he doing?
Not to him, but I've been very much in contact with these fundraiser people. So I understand that the situation has been sort of clarified and settled in a way, which is good.
So. Yeah, I met him for the first time at Punkt in Kristiansand. Yeah. And I was also very surprised what he actually was like in person.
Yeah.
I imagined he'd be kind of distant and kind of austere, like the master, but he was very down to earth, very New York-like, kind of nervous, you know. And then I saw him in New York a few times, and I saw Khairedin in New York and in Berlin, talked to him in these places. So yeah, hopefully he's okay.
He found Khairedin through Sivan. Like that was the connection. That he asked me actually, can I take him for my projects? Is that okay for you?
That project had a lot of people in it. And do you feel like this is the band where you really created this world music fusion in a different way than your other projects?
Yeah, in a way, it's I'm quite happy and I'm proud of that. It's not just a kind of a few applied layers of traditional music, or but that it's actually based on the musicians that are in it and their openness to stretch towards the parts of it that are not in their tradition anyway. So all these people come with a really strong background in whatever they have grown up with, like Derya Türkan from Turkey with his kemençe playing now, and Pedram Lubritombak, who is really one of the masters of percussion playing in the world. And Mona from Andalusian music also. And they all sort of leave what they came from and meet in this kind of center point where the music of Siwan is happening.
You didn't make your first solo recordings until, you know, the mid-2000s. Is that true or not?
True, yeah. Was it 2007? And no, I was not sure if I could handle that situation, actually. Because one thing is to record. You cannot always record 5 hours of music and then you pick out 40 of those and it will be an okay record. But then to go out and play solo concerts was a kind of scary thing for me that I avoided as long as possible. But in the end, it felt like, okay, the time has come. It has to be done. It's a challenge that it's just...
Why had the time come? Why did the time come then?
Yeah, good question. I think playing wise, I mean, my piano playing had been very sparse in a way, at least on acoustic piano. I was very much focused on melodic lines and not so much on you know, big fat chords or masses of just releasing the full power of the piano in a way. So maybe I guess you from the beginning of this century, I started rehearsing, practicing more, much more, how to use my left hand, and to sort of build up more complex textural stuff in my playing, which I felt that was a kind of a weapon that I needed to fill that role as a solo performer. So I was listening. There was an interview actually with Bill Evans, which came to my mind then when he spoke about Cecil Taylor actually, and he spoke about you always hear when a pianist starts to breathe through the piano, and that was a kind of a yeah. Very good phrasing. Very good way of describing what you actually need to arrive at as a piano performer. So I started working on that.
Your first solo ECM album is composed of many short pieces.
Yeah.
And if you were going to play a concert, would you also play very short pieces like that?
No, I've been playing. I've tried many different approaches, and in the beginning, I've done some concerts like that, but it feels very static to start and stop and start and stop. You need to be in a kind of a flow. Then I started to play the whole concert as one flow without any breaks. But then it felt better to put many of these short elements together, and I ended up playing, sort of dividing a concert in three parts, just like suites of music, which can be very melodic stuff, or it can be textural stuff, or it can be just short arguments in a way, like as in. So different combinations of these elements is what I ended up doing.
And so you know the concert was going to be in three longer parts, but you wouldn't be sure what was going to happen in each part, or did you already have a plan? Something was going to be atmospheric and then arguments. How much did you know beyond that it was going to be in three parts?
I always define as a starting point, and maybe knowing more or less what I would play at the end of the concert. But then I don't play with the scores or anything, but I have a kind of a graphic sheet with different titles connected in different ways and so on. So I could, if the idea doesn't come by itself, then I would take a little glimpse on this sheet and then, okay, maybe that, and then go from there while I was playing something else.
So were these titles of existing pieces or just titles of something that you would then invent totally?
Different, both. They were titles on pieces, but also sort of names I had given to textural ideas that could be any, just the first association that I came up with, I call it.
But so the textual ideas existed, or there was an idea for a texture that you then would have to invent? Do you remember some? Let's hear some of these words.
One is called Abdel, actually, after Abdel Wahab, which I spoke about, because it's a kind of a shadowing way of playing melodic lines, like alternating differently with the right and left hands in octaves, so that the lines sort of climb after each other, which reminded me of oud playing and that kind of thing. And then it's things like bubbling, and of course I don't remember any of that, but
you just remembered some. You remember them. And so how did this then become, lead you to make textures to go along with the piano sound?
That was actually an idea that I had been brooding in my mind for a long time, because I was of course listening a lot to John Hassell and Brian Eno and all that stuff going on at the time, and I was also doing theater music with the keyboards and synthesizers. So I started getting into that, and in the beginning synthesizers were not interesting to me because there was no velocity control, you know. But with the DX7, which I had the ability to work with in a 3-month long theater production in Oslo, I felt that, okay, here I can really develop something. And then when I started to play solo, I I started to imagine what the room could feed back to me when I was sitting there playing, which apart from the reverb, or in addition to the reverb, could there be, you know, elements of association that you could sort of hide in the reverb? So I started to experiment with that. I did this Book of Velocities as a pure thing because I felt I had to do that. But in already then I had this kind of urge to develop or to investigate this kind of composing in the reverb, anyway, which then led to Warp as a first experiment. And as I wrote to you, the result in Warp became much more, I mean, the soundscapes are much more present than I had initially planned, which was a result of working with Manfred and working with Jan-Erik and so on. So, but still the result was, I was very happy with the result, but then on Discourses I wanted somehow to connect the two elements even better, also by playing more lightly on the piano, or more delicately anyway, and also using sounds that in a way could connect more to the reverb of the piano. That was the
because even you know, your first solo album has a lot of that. It's a very present, the piano effects, you know, it sometimes doesn't sound like a piano. It's because you're really working off that in a very direct way. And it doesn't sound forced. It's not like a prepared piano. It's like this is going on in the piano and most people don't pay attention to it. So how did you make these soundscapes then? Do you have certain techniques you always use or different things?
No, there is all kinds of approaches to that. I was this Zoom that I'm now having on my desk here, I brought that along traveling around. So one of the tracks that you asked, this Geminate track, the opening there is from Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, which is this immense space. You know, I don't know if you've been there, but it's one of the largest indoor spaces I've been in.
Absolutely, amazing sound, yeah.
So it's just standing there in the middle there, and the people were finding a spot which was really far from other people, so you don't get this near voices, but just the energy of people moving around in that room is a huge. So that's one thing, and then it's continuing to experiment or just search with synthesizers and mess around with it actually, and then come up with some. This could be nice, you know. And then I prepared some stuff, especially for special tunes or compositions that I knew I would want to record in the studio. So I'm playing in key with the chord changes and so on. And then For these courses, I played all the piano, just recorded all the piano playing without any sound headset in my ears, and without, there was nothing recorded before that. So I just recorded these pieces, and then I took these prepared recorded soundscapes, and we added them. And there was a discussion then with Manfred and the sound engineer Stefano Lara, there are two, what worked and what didn't work, how strong it should be.
How did Manfred react to this method?
He has been really with me on that from the beginning. He was totally, like, really surprised and very enthusiastic. And I know that he has been playing Warp for lots of people in his network, sort of like Heiner Goebbels and different people around in Europe. He has been sort of promoting that record. Because he felt very engaged in that. Also for discourses.
Was Warp made a slightly different way?
Warp was half of it. I recorded just piano first, and then we added the stuff, and then the other half I had made the tracks. So I played the piano with the soundscapes on headset.
Do you feel the tools have advanced to a point where it's more direct to play them and work with them? Like, it's gotten much, much more musical.
And much more complex also, so because in the early, like, the DX7 is also very tiring to listen to in over a long stretch of time. It's this kind of devoid, it's the lack of overtones and the lack of kind of harmonic reverberation from acoustic spaces is very annoying to the ear. But as these sound processing tools get better, and the bit rate gets better, and the frequency the hertz rate gets better, then more and more it's a kind of an ambience where you can stay over a period of time.
How much do you manipulate these soundscapes that you've recorded? Do you feel like you're heavily processed things like you record in Hagia Sophia and other places? Or is it just you've got it and there it is and enough? Do you manipulate these sounds a lot?
I have been, for the field recordings that I've done, I've been just carefully manipulating, just looking at if I can pan them in different ways, if I can add delay, cross delays that pan in different ways, or sometimes you can make like three mono files which you put left, center and right, which gives more depth in a way in the center field of the and then of course EQing, taking away things that annoy you and so on, but mostly they are, I feel that I've chosen sounds that are interesting in themselves. So if you process too heavily, then they lose what they have of this quality that they have, which interested me in the first place. But all the everything that is inside the computer or a synthesizer, I've been processing a lot, really messing totally, and just seeing how far I can push it and how extreme I can go.
Do you feel like, you know, there are a handful of jazz pianists who decide to work with the piano and electronics in live performance or in recordings. In almost all these recordings except yours, the electronics are louder than the piano. You've put them in this background. I think that's very unusual. You know, if you look at others, so many people, the electronics get louder than the acoustic instrument. They take over and they're kind of in your face. You put them in this background sense, and yet, as you say, in the newer record, you wanted them to be more present. Do you think you're thinking differently than other in-between acoustic, electronic...
I don't know, but it's probably tempting to make some kind of backtrack and play on top of that once you have electronic tools in a live situation. And I can totally understand that, but I've felt that would be cheating on the the challenge that I spoke about. That is actually to go. This is a solo piano concert, but these other elements are there to enhance that in a way. It's not not a concert of electronic music with some colorful piano on top of it. So. And then once I got started with that, I felt that that situation is more and more interesting. Also, like I wrote you, that also when the soundscapes or the electronic sounds are not there, you still sort of lean forward and wonder, are they there? Or and that's that I feel it becomes more and more interesting to just have enough of that so that people actually keep listening for that the whole concert, even if it's not there.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And I also, live, I've also been doing a kind of a 6-channel speaker setup. So the piano comes from the stage, but these sounds can... I control them with the iPad, so I can sort of send, I can play something on the piano and then send a shadow of that to the back of the room, in a way. Which I feel is very satisfying to work with, because then you can sort of turn the room, or you can play with the architecture in.
So you're using the iPad just for like spatial mixing purposes, or also for other aspects?
No, it's iPads because there is a genius who made a program called the Sampler without the E. He's on the west coast of the US somewhere. He made this just for fun. It's totally brilliant tool for music. Okay, maybe I can show it to you. What is there is many of these prepared soundscapes from, but the good thing about that is that I don't have to look at it. Can I be totally focused on my piano playing, and I can just touch the iPad without, you know, if I had a computer on stage to do the electronics, I would have to lean forward and, you know, all that time waste stuff. So I can play with these sounds in my play.
That's one of the best things. That's true. It's so playable compared to this computer. That's like being at the office.
Yeah,
and exactly. So that's
so I have two of them then. One stereo output to the back of the room, and one stereo output to the middle of the room. And then I have this computer with a kind of a trigger thing that I can just step on. So I have the situation I have set up is that I'm totally on the piano playing a solo performance and then just adding.
Thank you, Yuan Balka, for all that beautiful music and the stories from where the music came from. Thanks to Simo Sesemishkreli for his research and editing assistance on this project. You'll find on Spotify a playlist called Yuan Balka Soundwalker, listing all the particular tracks that we put together with our talk today. Hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time.